argued here many times before. Ms. Gowdy, we're ready when you are.
Good morning. Kathy Gowdy, alternate defense counsel for the defendant, Mr. Michael Waldy. I would like to start this argument by talking about the issue of the deliberate introduction of jailhouse informant testimony into the trial. It falls short of the constitutional requirements for a fair trial and due process on several counts. First, it was not disclosed in discovery. The favorable offers that Lemuel Anderson was going to get as a result of his testimony, the benefits he got to his case, the reduction of sentencing, was not disclosed in discovery prior to his testimony. Secondly, it involved discussions that were a statement made in any connection with the plea bargaining process. Third, it violated his right to counsel, his Sixth Amendment right. Fourth, it was brought in the case in chief. It does not fall under the case law that says you can use that as impeachment if the defendant gets up and says something else was said. It is not an impeachment. And on this course, I need to acknowledge one error I made in my briefing of this matter. I requested an extension to file a reply brief in this matter. I did prepare the reply brief, and then I got stymied by working the PDF system we now have to do, and went into a jury trial, got the notice that we're having orals, and forgot I had not filed it. The only case I need to add to my argument was mentioned in my request for an extension to file the reply brief, but I understand that the people may need additional time to supplement, and that is the recent Supreme Court case of Ventress, Kansas v. Ventress, and the site of it is 129 Supreme Court 1841, 173 Lawyers Edition 2nd 801, and that was issued, I believe, on April 29th of 2009 of this year. And why that is important is that they discussed the statements in plea bargainings. They discussed not being disclosed, but in this case, they found that it was admissible, that it was clearly a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, but they found it was admissible to protect the integrity of the trial process, in that the defendant had gotten up the stand and denied the statements. So it was offerable for impeachment if the defendant commits perjury. And that actually is in accord with the Colorado line of cases, the Gelflin line, the Gelflin case, the Cole case, Deno, I believe, is a federal case. All of those state that if you get up on the stand and lie in your case in chief, which in this case would be the defendant's, it can be used, it can be discussed, or it can be used as impeachment. That is not the case here, and it's a really, really important point in this issue, in that the district attorney not only elicited this information without having disclosed in discovery, but she elicited it intentionally, as evidenced by her statements that I am bringing this out as it's a statement against interest. They did not have the pretrial hearing that Cole requires. And it states in Cole, we hold that a defendant who challenges the voluntariness or reliability of statements the defendant has made is entitled to a pretrial hearing for the judge to evaluate this matter.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I want to make sure we're understanding the precise comments that you're objecting to.
Yes.
There was questioning, and I'm just looking at the transcript, and he said, what did he tell you about the charges he was facing is the question. Answer, he was charged with first degree murder, okay, and that his plea bargain was 72 years and then it was 48 years. So that's statement one. And the second one was, did he say anything further about what he thought about that process? Answer, that if he could get it down to 16 years for manslaughter, that he would try and get it.
The second one is the big one, yes.
Well, the second one, the first one, I can understand that that runs afoul of Rule 11 and the statute, because that specifically talks about, references plea bargaining. Second one doesn't, does it?
Well, he's stating he would take manslaughter. It's part of what he thinks he's being offered in plea because it was tied in with that was what Ms. Morrison did accept for a plea bargain in her case.
Yeah, but he didn't say that that would. He said, if I could get down to 16 years for manslaughter, that he would try, that I would try and get it. So, I mean, that's not, that's talking about what his own personal views are about what he would take. It isn't, he's not negotiating with L.A. He's not negotiating. There's nothing from that statement that indicate that there's ever been a proposal like that to the district attorney. He's just saying, that's what I would like to get if I could get it. And is that, how is that barred by either Rule 410 or Rule 11 or the statute?
I think that there's an assumption in there that's his own statement. When that is the plea bargain that was offered to a co-defendant, it is reasonable that that is also what he was discussing with his counsel. There you have the Sixth Amendment right. And that the counsel was trying to get that in plea negotiations, all of which should have been brought out in a pretrial hearing, so we would have had it fully fleshed out, rather than all of this occurring before the jury, in front of them, including the motion for mistrial. It falls afoul of it because it is part of the plea negotiation processes. It wasn't an indicia of guilt. He wasn't saying I killed him. He was saying if I can get out of life, the 72 years in the previous sentence you quoted, and I could get it down to manslaughter in 16 years, I'll take it. That's all, it's all contextual. It all flows together. And it all is.
These two statements can't be separated.
I think they can be separated, but I think they have to be read together for purpose of this argument. I don't say they're the same statement, but they flow, and there's a part, and they're all part of the plea negotiation process. You don't sit there and say, I'm going to take manslaughter if you're not talking about a plea.
Pardon me, Ms. Gowdy. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm concerned about your argument in light of who your client was talking to. He wasn't talking to a prosecutor or even a police officer. He was talking to another inmate. And People versus Rawlins, out of another division of this court, seems to indicate that that matters a lot. Would you address that for me, please, and put my concerns to rest if you can?
I would state it goes back to the Cole requirement. There's a pretrial hearing, so this can be fleshed out. Our record's inadequate because all of this was being done in front of the jury. But it is all part of the plea process. The Ventress case involves where they sent in a jailhouse informant and he's just talking to the person. In that case, there was some indicia of government agency, but in the same hand, the person talking didn't know it. It's exactly the same. He's talking to his cellie, he's talking to someone next to him, he's talking about his case, which is obviously the most important and pressing thing on his mind, and he's discussing what's going on in his case. Under Ventress, this was found to be a violation. But because he lied about his statement, it was then found to be a misimpeachment. It went into a different constitutional right other than the Sixth Amendment. In this particular case, it is a violation of the Sixth Amendment right. Yes, he should not have been running his mouth. I'm sure his counsel advised him not to. However, it involves the plea process, and if you're allowed to bring in people, what people are talking about the plea process and say, well, it wasn't to a DA, it wasn't to his lawyer, then the rule has very little power at all except within the court. To assume that the client body are not going to discuss this with other people and then can be brought in, then any statements involving plea can be brought in.
But going back to Judge Miller's question, isn't there a difference between the DA made me such and such an offer? I can see where your argument goes there, mm-hmm. But then the next statement, you know, I think that I'd be willing to plead guilty for something less, which is not part of the discussion, i.e. the DA didn't bring it out, defense counsel didn't bring it out in the course of plea negotiations. He's simply saying, I'll sell my responsibility more, you know, for a cheaper sentence. That strikes me as being a classic statement against interest that has little connection to the actual plea bargaining process.
Well, any statement that you would make about the plea bargaining process would be by its very nature a statement against interest because there's some indication that you're willing to assume guilt. So it's a statement against interest under that is inculpatory. However, it also then is also part of the plea process. You wouldn't be discussing, I would take manslaughter if you're not looking at a plea. And the rule is clear that it states any statement made in any connection, It doesn't say it has to be the lawyer or the DA or anyone falls within it. And it goes back to Cole and Gelfland that you bring it forward if you're the DA saying, this is the statement, I want to use it. And we have a chance for the trial court to look at it in advance. So all of these issues are fleshed out. So the person, so the defendant knows that your client has run his mouth and that what we are facing. Secondly, in this particular case, the defense counsel had requested a continuance because he wanted to explore this particular informant prior to trial, and that was denied. He renewed his request for continuance along with the mistrial, neither of which is granted, during the trial because things came out. It was ingenuous of the district attorney to state, well, I just found this in my interview, so I didn't need to disclose it. The statement was never disclosed, and that goes into argument two. And it clearly is an impeachment statement because the person had so, it's not isolatable. The person has so much to gain by giving the statement, and he gained it. He got out of jail. He got a reduced sentence. All of that had not been disclosed. All of it ties in is that they have him sitting there braiding his hair, and he is talking about his case in the cell and saying, I would take this if I could get it, which is exactly the same sentence as Morrison got. So there is connection to the plea sentence. He also did discuss the terms of his plea bargain. It also did put forward matters of sentencing in front of the jury, which are clearly improper.
Excuse me. I'm sorry to interrupt again, but let's assume we agree with you on that, that it was improper. I guess I still have a problem with whether or not this is harmless error. The trial judge did tell him not to raise that subject again. It was not raised again. It was not covered in closing arguments. There is some other very damaging testimony. There's an eyewitness. The girlfriend places him at the scene. And as you know, there are several statements that L.A., the inmate, makes that are strongly incriminating towards Mr. Statements that he attributes to your the defendant. So I have a hard time seeing why this would not, or maybe you can explain to us why this would not constitute harmless error.
I think because a juror who is a layman who is not familiar with the plea process, who does not understand the essential nature of a plea process and keeping the justice system going, and in fact, most I think most layman people I think say, oh, he got a plea bargain. You know, that it's bad. It has bad connotations. It was material because it says, I'll take manslaughter. It's an indication of guilt, it's a confession. And because it's a confession, it needed to be protected by all of the constitutional parameters that go around confessions. Was it voluntary? Was it involuntary? And the circumstances. It's material because it implies guilt.
So you're saying it's sort of almost like structural error, that it's per se reversible error whenever a statement like this comes up, even, no matter what measures the trial court takes to try to correct the error?
In this particular case, I would say, I don't know about every case because I think it would have to be fact specific. But in this particular case, yes, I do believe it was material and structural. If it wasn't material, why was the district attorney trying to get it in? It's in their case in chief. It wasn't impeachment. So it's when they're doing
it. Well, that's true with any piece of evidence that's offered, and frequently it's found to be harmless mm-hmm. error. So.
But it goes to the ultimate question, guilt or innocence. People don't say, I'll take manslaughter, if there isn't an assumption they did it. So the statement coming in is an assumption that he did it.
Ms. Gowdy, assume for the purposes of argument this wasn't a statement about a plea negotiation. He just simply told his cellmate, I did it, hypothetically. And his cellmate would testify to that at trial. Are you saying that we apply a voluntariness test to statements that defendants make to police, to people who have no connection to the police?
Not in all cases. In this case, I am, because it was not disclosed before. The reason they have pretrial hearings on this is so that they avoid this happening in front of the jury.
But how, what does that have to do with a voluntariness standard? I understand your discovery okay. argument, but what does that have to do with a voluntariness standard? This was not connected to the police. This fellow wasn't a police agent. At least there's no evidence of that. So are that under your analysis, there would have to be a voluntariness hearing for every statement a defendant makes to anybody. And I don't think that's what the law says, is it?
I believe that, no, you would have a suppression issue. you would be able to file a suppression if you knew about it before trial. And because one of the questions that goes into Valentin is was the statement really made? That you go into the hearing and you say, was it made? Let's take a look. What's your reason? What do you remember? And in some senses, it then requires the defendant to have to take the stand. It goes into his Curtis advisement, into his right to testify on his own defense or remain silent. So not in every case. In this particular case, yes, I think there was a voluntary argument. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter. I don't think that these statements fall under 410. I don't know that that was an actual offer by the prosecutor as to the 72 and 48 years. And as has been pointed out, the 16 years sent for manslaughter seems to be more just his hope of what would be offered. And I think there are, such as in Rollins and other cases, they show that these kinds of statements aren't protected under 410. But even if a portion of them were, the trial court instructed the jury they weren't to consider any statements regarding plea negotiations, any of this testimony, and there was no further testimony on that point. So I don't think the trial court abused its discretion in denying the defendant's motion for mistrial based on this evidence coming out.
Ms. Van Horn, there is clearly a difference in vocabulary used between the statute and the rule of criminal procedure on one hand and 410 on the other hand. Rollins seems to glide over that difference. Could you address that difference for me?
As I recall, in that 410 is supposed to trump that language in 410, although when you look at how 410 has been analyzed, it's if you read 410 itself, of course, it does say any statement, evidence of a plea of guilty or an offer to plead guilty made in connection with any of the foregoing pleas or offers is not admissible. And I guess to me it turns on what you mean, any statement made in connection with a plea.
But isn't the statute different? Isn't the statute broader based upon the language of the statute?
I don't recall exactly the wording of the statute. But I was just looking at the cases, interpreting how we look at 410.
Well, let me, excuse me, I think that the statute and Rule 11 both talk about the fact of plea negotiations being disclosed and that not being admissible, as opposed to 410 seems to be more aimed at content, whether or not, and getting into what the discussions were. And I was discussing, going through with a counsel for the defendant, there is his first statement that the effect that the people were offering 72 or 48 years. I know you're saying that there's no, I think you're saying you're not sure whether that was ever offered or not.
Correct,
but I don't
Your
think
Honor.
That in the, as I looked at the record, nobody ever said no, there never were any plea negotiations. So I mean, I think it's fair to assume that there were some type of plea negotiations, and then that fact was coming out through that first statement. Doesn't that make sense?
That makes sense, but I don't look at this as being true evidence of plea negotiations. I guess I'm looking at it rather narrowly.
Well, no, it's not evidence of plea negotiation. It's evidence of the fact that defendant or his defense counsel and district attorney engaged in plea discussions. That fact itself is inadmissible under Rule 11 and under the statute. So it seems to me that clearly runs afoul. The second statement where he says,
I would take 16 years for manslaughter if they'd offer it.
Yeah, and specifically says that if he could get it down to 16 years for manslaughter, that he would try and get it. And I think arguably the it is if he could get the bargain that's being negotiated down to 16 years. So doesn't that statement also run afoul of Rule 11 and of the statute? Because it's again referring to the fact of plea negotiations.
I don't think so, because I think it's referring to actual plea negotiations, and that is not an actual plea negotiation, that part of it. If you read it that way, I can see where you could say the other two perhaps would be evidence of plea negotiations, even though we don't have evidence that those, that was in fact part of a plea negotiation, that there were plea negotiations. But even if you can read...
Well, we do have evidence. I mean, I grant you it might be hearsay, but we do have evidence.
Right. I mean, if we can read that, he's not just saying that to his friend. If we can say, okay, take that as being evidence that the prosecutors were negotiating with him for a plea offer, I think this statement does not fall. But my major point...
What does the "it" refer to? Someone says, if I could get it down, isn't he referring to if I can get the plea bargain down to 16 years? I think it's a little different from what Judge Bernard was referring. Well, I don't think it is what Judge Bernard was referring to. But if what had happened is the defendant just out of the blue says to his friend, "Gee, you know, I'm concerned about this case. If I could get a plea bargain, I would plead guilty to manslaughter for 16 years." No indication of any kind of plea bargains. He just says it. That's one thing. But here he's saying that in the context of what are presented as plea bargain negotiations. So doesn't that kind of run up against the Rule 11?
Not necessarily. I mean, as far as I know at this point, of course, the plea negotiations could have ended long before. So there might not have been plea negotiations going on at this time when he made the statement. And I think it's more comparable with just saying, boy, if I could get a plea bargain for this, I would take it, that it's apart from plea negotiations. But even if any of this ran afoul of the rule, I think the trial court's instruction to the jury was sufficient to cure any prejudice. And we're looking at this under an abuse of discretion standard. Not only did the trial court prohibit further references to plea negotiations, it also instructed the jury not to consider that at all, the testimony they had already heard.
Part of the argument I understand opposing counsel would be making is that there should have been a pretrial hearing on this issue, and there wasn't. And that's one of the reasons we don't have any indication of how these conversations allegedly arose. Do you agree that there should have been a pretrial hearing on this?
I'm not familiar with that procedure, and because the claim wasn't presented in the opening brief, I really didn't take a look at that. But I'm not familiar with that procedure.
Let me ask you about the prosecutorial misconduct allegation. The allegation is that this information was gleaned pretrial, or at least during the presentation of the prosecution's case in chief, and therefore it should have at least been disclosed, and that defendant had no opportunity to cross-examine the jailhouse witness about favorable terms that he received. What's your response to that?
From what I remember from the record, they didn't move for a mistrial on this basis. What the prosecutor said initially is some of these statements came up Friday, the Friday before trial, during an interview with this witness, and they weren't reduced to writing, so we didn't have to turn them over, and they weren't exculpatory. And then they were discussing this whole issue, and although defense counsel used the terms, this is a discovery violation, defense counsel never asked the court to make a ruling on whether there was a discovery violation or not. And it seemed to me to be once the court gave the instructions to the jury that was that. So there wasn't a lot of talk about, we didn't have more information about this witness, et cetera, et cetera. It sort of focused on the hair braiding aspect. From time, they that was the big thing, as I recall from trial, this hair braiding statement that defense counsel wasn't aware of. And so the trial court, after they discussed this, said, okay, I'm just going to limit you to the information that's contained within the written reports, prosecutor. You can't ask him anything that's outside of these written reports, which were disclosed prior to trial. So they were aware this witness was testifying, but so I think that was sufficient also to cure any prejudice.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. That concludes the arguments for today. Court will be in recess. The bailiff may announce it.
court will be recessed subject to call.
Thank you.